Welcome to RAPcast, the official podcast of Rheumatology Advanced Practice Providers. I'm Amanda Mixon, president of RAP, and I'm thrilled to guide you through another insightful discussion today. In this episode, we're diving into a topic that's top of mind for many in our field, the new ACR guideline summary for lupus nephritis. These updates are critical for enhancing care strategies and optimizing outcomes for patients managing this challenging condition. To help unpack key takeaways and implications of these new guidelines, I'm joined by Jennifer Mylod, a seasoned expert in rheumatology and a respected voice in the field. Jen, for our listeners who haven't had the pleasure of meeting you, can you help give me a quick introduction?
Yes, of course. Hello, everyone. My name is Jennifer Mylod. I am a nurse practitioner working out of Phoenix, Arizona at Arizona Arthritis and Rheumatology Associates. I've been working in rheumatology for 10 amazing years. Thank you, Amanda, for inviting me to join you today to discuss such an important update for our RAP community.
Well, I'm really excited to have you. Together, we'll explore what these updates mean for clinical practice, patient management, and the evolving role of advanced practice providers in lupus nephritis care. So for you listeners, settle in and we will go ahead and get started. We'll dive into specific portions of the guideline summary, but I was wondering what your overall take is. What stuck out to you as notable and what are your global thoughts on it?
Yes, I think the most notable update is that we have more options to treat lupus nephritis patients than ever before. And it's great for these new therapeutics to have specific points of use based on systematic reviews and expert opinions so that everyday clinicians like us know best how to care for these really sick patients. I really like that the 2024 guidelines are more succinct. They're easier to read. They give us really important recommendations for low daily dosing for maintenance prednisone and how long we should maintain that for ongoing remission for these patients. They also included quite a bit of pediatric-specific guidelines, which is great for our pediatric advanced practice providers as well.
I know, you know, the last guidelines we had were from 2012, and so much has changed there with new therapies, and we've really kind of changed how we manage lupus nephritis. You know, to your point, not starting out with those high-dose glucocorticoids, which obviously steroids are wonderful for our patients. They're game-changers, lifesavers, but also lead to toxicity issues. And so it's really nice to have more succinct guidelines, I totally agree, where, you know, we can review these things and it helps give us, I think, more clear guidance on how to manage, how to, you know, monitor these patients, but also then, you know, what to do when we're faced with a challenge. You know, and as part of that, the guidelines really emphasize this regular screening of protein in the urine for patients with lupus. So how should we as clinicians implement this practice and what challenges, you know, might occur?
Yes, this is a great question, Amanda, because it helps address what applies to our SLE patients without lupus nephritis. So we make sure we're appropriately evaluating them for new onset nephritis. The ACR recommends that SLE patients are screened every 6 to 12 months or if they're flaring, which should include a complete urine analysis, a urine protein, and a urine creatinine so we can determine the urine protein to creatinine ratio. And a normal ratio is less than 0.2 grams per gram. And I think we can implement this pretty easily into our practice. It's very helpful to have it readily available on your SLE lab order set. So, you know, talk to your IT people if it's not there. That can help quite a bit. And I don't think there's too many challenges to doing this on a routine basis. Our patients may wonder, like, why do you need to do a urine sample and blood samples? I explain to my patients, this is recommended that we monitor your urine on a regular schedule so that we can promptly identify if there's any worsening of your chronic condition, and then we can limit any complications as fast as possible.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I think, you know, having clear cut, this is how, you know, this is how often we should be doing it, I think is helpful. You know, especially when we're talking to our patients, I kind of say the same thing when I'm talking to a lupus patient. I say, hey, you know, they're pretty used to it now, but hey, I'm going to need a urine. I'm just looking to make sure you're not spilling any blood or protein that might mean the kidneys might potentially be impacted by your lupus. And we're just doing that to be thorough. You know, the biggest challenge I think I see is unfortunately compliance. You know, sometimes my lupus patients tend to come in and out, especially when they're younger. And obviously, you know, we know our younger patients are kind of the ones we worry about the most. And so sometimes my challenge is actually just getting them to come in. And so, you know, I really try to enforce, like, this is super important, you know, for you. One of the very, very first patients when I first started in rheumatology, which was a very long time ago, was a young girl that I saw actually at a free clinic that I was volunteering at. And I will never forget her because I go to this free clinic and I'm volunteering thinking I'm going to keep up with my primary care skills shortly after, you know, starting to work in rheumatology. And I realized pretty fast, A, even back then, which was 2007, there really wasn't, you know, enough rheumatology providers even back then. But also, obviously, patients that are at a lower socioeconomic status do worse. Yeah. They fall through the cracks. And I met this young girl who had actually been in a clinical trial, but then once the trial was done, she no longer followed up. And so she was coming in, and she came in, and it was the winter, and she came in with her little baby that she had just had. Aww. And the first time that I saw her, her biggest concern was she was having trouble, you know, picking up her baby. And so she went to this free clinic. She didn't have insurance. And, you know, the first time I saw her, I thought, oh, she's got arthritis, but she had this diagnosis of lupus. And, you know, I said, well, you know, and again, keep in mind, I'm probably like 6 months in, so I don't even really know what I'm doing. I don't even really know all the medicines. And I saw her and I said, well, you know, we need to do some labs. And, you know, I knew that much. And I knew, I'm like, we need to get a urine test on you. And, you know, I leave for my evening, you know, after that. So she leaves her samples and then she goes, you know, she leaves. And then I knew I was going to be seeing her the following week to kind of go over her results, et cetera. And, you know, as the results started coming in, I quickly realized she was very, very, very sick. And she, you know, obviously had both blood and protein in her urine. Yeah. Her labs and were like, really, really
and
bad.
And how much do you think like you could tell that from her urine versus like just the blood sample too? Like, I feel like there's so many patients I've seen where their blood work actually doesn't look that bad. Like they're not having any cytopenias. They're not having any obvious like kidney issues from a CMP, but then their urine looks like horrible. And it's like, how many times is like, has this been maybe missed before? Because someone wasn't checking the right thing. So
it's so true.
For this patient, like, did you see that? Did you see it was like maybe more the urine than the blood work?
It was really in the urine, and she had really high positive double-stranded. Complements were nothing, you know, at that point. And, you know, I realized, you know, first and foremost, I'm dealing with a really, really sick patient. And to be completely transparent, I didn't know what to do. I called the rheumatologist that I worked with, who, remember, she wasn't volunteering at this free clinic. and it was just me. And, you know, obviously the primary care that this was at didn't really know what to do either. And fortunately, the rheumatologist that I worked with agreed to see her. Her name is Dr. Beals. She is an absolute, was a mentor, mother type figure to me. And she agreed to see her after hours for free. Because again, I knew that point I could not manage her by myself. Yeah. Unfortunately, ultimately, she passed away pretty sudden, you know, pretty soon after I saw her. And, it, you know, obviously there was a series of things that transpired, but I will never forget this patient. You know, for a few reasons. Obviously, first and foremost, it was the first really, really sick patient that I had seen. But also, we didn't have the therapies that we have now, and especially for somebody that doesn't have insurance. And so it was just kind of one, at that point, she was so sick that there really wasn't a lot that could be done. She was hospitalized, and then again, ultimately, she passed away. And I went to her funeral, and she was just such a light, and I will never, ever forget her and why it really obviously makes me feel so honored to practice medicine and do this, but to see the therapies emerge because it doesn't have to be like that, right? And with proper monitoring, you know, we can save our patients' lives. And, you know, again, even with these new guidelines, they're different than what we had in 2012. And definitely on that note,
big changes.
You know, big changes, which I think are reflective of the new therapies that we have. And mm-hmm. they propose this preference for this triple therapy in managing patients with active lupus nephritis. So can you help me walk through this regimen and what it entails and why it's preferred over dual therapy in certain cases?
Yes. So triple therapy is definitely the biggest change with the new guidelines. To start, I do want to take a step back and remind our listeners that all SLE patients are recommended to be on hydroxychloroquine at baseline. And then second to that, an ACE or an ARB should be added if there is any elevation in proteinuria at all, any elevation. And then we go immediately to triple therapy. And the first arm is glucocorticoid pulse, which is methylprednisolone, 250 to 1,000 milligrams IV, once daily for 1 to 3 days, and then switch to an oral glucocorticoid, which should be less than or equal to 0.5 milligrams per kilogram per day, and then with a max dose being 40 milligrams a day. And I think that might be one change right there that some of us are like, okay, max 40 milligrams. But I think if we're starting with that methylprednisolone pulse, like we're really going to get that inflammation down fast. And then we're going to taper with that target dose to be equal to or 5 milligrams per day by 6 months. So that's a pretty rapid taper that they're hoping we can institute for these patients. And the second arm to help us get there is the mycophenolate from mofetil or the mycophenolic acid. And per the Euro-LN trial, low-dose cyclophosphamide could also be used. That's 500 milligrams every 2 weeks for 6 doses. And this is also an option, but MFF is preferred first line. And patients who start with cyclophosphamide should be switched to MMF after 12 weeks. And then the third arm is belimumab or calcineurin inhibitor therapy, which includes cyclosporin, tacrolimus, or the most recent FDA approval with voclosporin. Triple therapy is preferred over dual therapy based on the level of evidence from multiple trials showing that triple therapy improves patients' chance to control inflammation sooner, thus reducing the medication toxicity by lowering their doses of glucocorticoids sooner while we're limiting damage to their kidneys.
So now with that triple therapy recommendation, they state that steroids should be used with either mycophenolate plus belimumab or mycophenolate plus a calcineurin inhibitor like voclosporin, or the Eurolupus nephritis trial, which consists of low-dose cyclophosphamide plus belimumab. How should our listeners choose between these three options? Is there data to guide when one regimen might be optimal compared to another?
So that third arm is very variable based on which histopathology class the patient landed in with their biopsy and the severity of the proteinuria, which is gleaned from multiple studies. For class 3 and 4, or if they have a mix of class 5, the options are belimumab or a calcineurin inhibitor. And for a patient that has more significant extrarenal symptoms and less severe lupus nephritis determined by that proteinuria, then belimumab can be chosen over a calcineurin inhibitor. If patients in those classes have proteinuria that's greater than 3 grams per gram, they only recommend a calcineurin inhibitor over belimumab. And for pure class 5 with proteinuria that's greater than 1 gram per gram, then they recommend a calcineurin inhibitor as well for that. Most of the data places cyclophosphamide as comparable or not inferior to mycophenolic acid analogs. But I think likely the choice between these two is going to be based on access, probably tolerability to either option, and possibly regional differences as well.
Well, and just thinking about, you know, cyclophosphamide for our young mm-hmm. patients that maybe want to have a child, it also adds kind of another, you know, component there as well. So, I mean, again, all things that we have to think about in these kind of sick patients. I will say that this is also really why it's important to make connections with nephrology because, mm-hmm. you know, us helping them. I think we work so much better, you know, together. I have a lupus nephritis patient that I'm managing right now, and I'm really co-managing with a really great nephrologist. And we're talking almost every day about, should we do a biopsy? You know, all of these various things. And then I know we'll work together to make sure that this patient gets the appropriate care kind of based on, you know, what the biopsy shows. And then also utilizing these new guidelines. There's strong recommendation for lower dose glucocorticoid regimen, which I know you already mentioned, really to minimize toxicities. So What strategies can clinicians use to achieve this while maintaining efficacy in treatment?
The experts really believe that we can achieve the low-dose glucocorticoids by using triple therapy and then do regular monitoring, so keeping a very close eye on them to make sure that we're achieving that renal response. And then if not, if we're not achieving that renal response, then we need to adjust our therapy.
Absolutely. The recommendations for monitoring protein in the urine and complement levels are quite specific. So how do these monitoring practices influence treatment adjustments and long-term outcomes for patients with lupus nephritis?
So the guidelines recommend checking proteinuria at least every 3 months and then complement levels with double-stranded DNA no more than monthly and every office visit, which should be pretty much every 1 to 3 months. These help us to evaluate their renal response. If a patient does not have a complete renal response, which is defined as proteinuria that's less than 0.5 grams per gram within 6 to 12 months, if they're on dual therapy, then we should start triple therapy. And if they're already on triple therapy, then we need to change to an alternative third arm option, kind of like how we discussed. You have the option between belimumab or a calcineurin inhibitor or cyclophosphamide. That's kind of when it's like, hey, we might need to be thinking about one of those other third options if we haven't met that at that 6 month mark. If they have achieved that complete renal response on whatever triple therapy or dual therapy that you've put them on, then they should maintain on that same therapy for at least 3 to 5 years. And the goal driving these monitoring recommendations is to preserve the kidney function. We want to reduce the morbidity and the mortality of chronic kidney disease while minimizing the medication-related toxicities.
The guidelines stress the importance of shared decision-making in addressing healthcare disparities. What are some practical ways rheumatology teams can ensure these principles are being upheld?
So I don't know how practical it is to, with shared decision-making and addressing some of these disparities, I think a lot of it is the relationships we have with our patients. With shared decision-making, we need to get to know our patients. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that there's a practical way to do that. I think it's kind of like very touchy-feely. It helps so much to understand them, what drives them, their values, their goals. Often I find that patients don't feel like they have a voice, especially patients with lupus nephritis. They're very sick and they don't really understand what's happened to them. They are scared. They feel alone. As their provider, we have so much power to either change this for them or to help them feel or to make them feel like that hole is getting deeper. Shared decision making is about understanding that individual sitting in the exam room and then exploring all the options with them. I don't think it's our job as their healthcare provider to tell them how to live their lives. I think that is how healthcare disparities can widen. We cannot assume to know how our patients live or want to live their lives. It's our job to help them understand what has happened to them and then empower them to make the best of it. Give them the tools and the resources they need to make their life the best version it can be, given the circumstances they are facing and based on how they want to lead it. So much of what we want for our patients to do to improve their outcomes is based on daily decisions they are making when they are not in our offices. It makes me think about your patient that you had in the free clinic. Like, What kind of challenges was she facing that was keeping her from getting the access that she needed? These patients needed to decide for themselves to make their health a priority, to take their medicines, to listen to their body and their symptoms, to exercise, to eat healthier, to choose a healthy way to respond to stress. Empowering patients to let them know they have a choice in how they are treated opens up communication in really meaningful ways. It allows them and the patient, allows us and the patient the opportunity to address the obstacles impeding their best outcomes, like their baseline health knowledge, their job opportunities, their access to healthy food and exercise. Your patient may not be eating unhealthy because they don't care to, but because they can't afford to. It can be very easy for us to assume why patients live their lives the way they do, but until we take the time to get to know them and understand them, we are missing the opportunities to provide excellent care to them and to give them the best chance at living the healthiest, fullest life they can.
I couldn't agree more. You know, I think that's why APPs are so good, I feel like. You know, yeah. I do believe we do a really good job of listening to our patients and really getting to know them. Not that rheumatologists don't, but
It's what makes a difference between a good provider, no matter APP or physician or medical assistant, right? It's like if you care for your patients, if you listen to them, like, you're going to be a good provider. You're going to listen. You're going to hear what is bothering them and what's going on with them and then be able to help them address it.
Absolutely. You know, I always say to all of my patients, like, we're a team. You have to feel good about it. I have to feel good about it. But if mm-hmm. if either one of us don't feel good about it, it's not going to go well. And I've really always practiced that way. I say to my patients, listen, I would not tell you or advise you to do something I wouldn't do myself or mm-hmm. any member of my family. And mm-hmm. I really try to remember that when I'm seeing a patient, when I walk in that door, that to your point, we don't know what happens when they leave that room. And, mm-hmm. you know, we don't know what their lives are like. And we're just getting this little snippet. And so I'm definitely never a provider that, you know, scolds my patients when they aren't taking their therapies like they're supposed to. Like that never goes well, right? Like,
no.
I'm amazed.
I hear stories like that from my patients where they'll tell me, they're like, thank you so much for listening to me. XYZ happened. And they'll tell me about this experience with, I just had a patient tell me yesterday about an experience she had with a cardiologist. And I was just like, I could not believe like that there's still people practicing medicine in this way. I'm just like, I feel so bad for my patients that they have like people to treat them that way. I'm like, it's such improvement to be made in our healthcare system. That's what I will say.
I totally agree. I know. I feel the same way. And obviously it sounds like we practice pretty similarly. And I tell all my patients, listen, you have to be an advocate for yourself. And also remember, like, healthcare is a business. Like, you as the patient, you know, you are the consumer. So if you are not happy with, you know, the care that you're getting, then, you know, you have to speak up, because mm-hmm. it is important that we work as a team. And I find that by doing that, patients trust me more. They're more apt mm-hmm. to come to their appointments. They're more apt to do mm-hmm. what I'm asking them to do, to go get that urine test when I'm asking them to. Right. You know, we don't have a lab right in our office, so they have to actually kind of go, you know, sometimes across the parking lot, et cetera. But when they understand why this is so important for their own health, I think it matters, and they're more apt to do it.
Yeah. Well, I think they'll communicate their obstacles too. So if you tell them, I need you to do this, this, and this, and they don't have that comfortability with you, that trust with you, they're not going to be honest and tell you, hey, I can't actually go do that blood work or that urine test today, or I can't afford that medicine. They're not going to feel comfortable to tell you those things. And then you're going to be thinking that everything's hunky-dory and this patient's on the road to that renal response, but they're not, because they have these obstacles in place.
Yeah. So it's really breaking down those barriers so that there's trust there, so that we can have open conversations with our patients, so that we do know that they're taking their medicines, or to your point, they can't afford their medicine. And what can we do then, you know, to help this patient so that they are able to, you know, either get their therapies, et cetera, utilize various programs, whatever, so that they stay on their medicine, so that they, you know, don't end up in renal failure, on dialysis, needing a kidney transplant. You know, I mean, all of those things are so important. And, you know, like I said, in my career, I've unfortunately seen patients pass from lupus nephritis and the complications mm-hmm. after a kidney, you know, a kidney transplant, et cetera. And I'll never forget that first patient. You know, in some ways, it made me say, did I pick the right field? Like, I don't want to see sick people like this, you know, dying. But then now that I have stuck it out and stayed, now that we do have these new therapies and we aren't needing such high dose glucocorticoids, and seeing patients do well, it's like, nope, I definitely did pick the right field. When you see patients surviving and living well and without, you know, you wouldn't know that person is sick, right? Because they're just out living their lives. So
I think that's what's so great about rheumatology, and definitely what has really given me a fulfilling career in rheumatology, is developing those relationships with patients and helping them figure out what's wrong with them, what's happening to them, and then empowering them. And then just seeing them turn their lives around, you know, with the medications, but their lifestyle choices are so important too. So it's so great to develop these relationships with them and then just see them prosper and grow and enjoy such amazing quality of life. Like, oh, it's so fulfilling. I love it. I want everyone to have fulfilling careers like that.
Me too. I tell my patients now, like, we're growing old together, and which is so remarkable, right? Like, what kind of field do you get to go into where you literally get to see people for their lifetime and they get to see you? I mean, my patients are like, I remember when you were pregnant, and it felt like I was pregnant for 7 years, you know, but, But it's so true. Like they do, they get to see us go through things. We get to see them go through things. And, mm-hmm. and I don't know. I mean, obviously I think mostly we're speaking to our listeners are mostly rheumatology APPs, but if for some reason you're in primary care and you're listening or in another set, you know, subspecialty, come join us in rheumatology. It's really right. awesome. Like
it's so fulfilling. We love it.
We do. I know. It's why I really do enjoy going to work every day. Well, again, thank you so much, Jennifer. That brings us to an end of this episode. And I so appreciate you sharing your insights and your expertise and breaking down those guidelines on lupus nephritis. It's obviously always inspiring to hear perspectives that can help us grow as clinicians and improve the care that we provide to our patients.
Thank you so much for having me, Amanda. Rapcast is a phenomenal source of learning, and it's a pleasure to be a part of this episode.
For more resources and updates from RAP, please visit our website at rap.org or follow us on social media where our X and Instagram handles are at RoomAPP. Our content room is constantly updated with new digital education, which you can find on our new RAP ACE 2.0 mobile app. That's absolutely incredible. If you don't have it, please download it. You'll start to get the notifications like I do when something new is being posted, which has been awesome. As always, thank you so much for tuning in and for the work that you do every day to make a difference in your patients. Until next time, take care and keep advancing the field of rheumatology one patient at a time. I'm Amanda Mixon, and this has been RAPcast.